Chapter 4. No Slave. Arrival on Terra. The Coming of Death. The Vengeful Spirit, Lunar Orbit, 14th of Secundus.
This place you have made here, Laek, I do not like it, growled Abaddon.
The temple existed in no plan of the Vengeful Spirit, but it was but one of many changes the ship had undergone. As Horus's power grew, the Warmaster's flagship left behind the constraints of the Materium, twisting itself away from its original form to please new shipwrights, whose concerns were not those of human beings. Under their direction, it became as mutable as potter's clay. Sections vanished. Huge parts of the structure heaved with pseudo-organic life. Areas resounded to screams that came from no human mouth. Adornments of spikes and grimacing statues grew overnight, then vanished the next day. Inconstant doorways opened into strange mirror worlds where men were lost forever. If logic were followed, the great black doors that led into the temple should have opened directly onto the void. But it was clear that logic had no place there, and that the temple was not on the ship. It lay in some place beyond the void and the universe that contained it, where the laws of physics did not hold true. An interstice between dimensions, perhaps, or a pocket of the warp, Abaddon guessed. The air was frigid, though the metal radiated a dangerous heat that bit at his flesh through his terminator plate. High windows let in sickly light that gave no hint of the vast armada shoaling around the flagship, or of Luna beneath its keel, or of the stars, but showed an endless, curdled swirl of colours that hurt the eye and the mind to see. Members of Laek's Unspeaking lurked in guard alcoves, all of them wearing armour as bizarrely decorated as their masters. Abaddon did not like the fact that Laek's men guarded it instead of his own. When Horus had ordered it to be so, an ugly look had come over him, as if he tested his son, though to what end Abaddon could not discern. Like the vessel that carried him, the Warmaster was no longer what he had once been. The chamber's air reeked of incense that was sweet at first breath, harsh with bitterness and iron scents on the second, foul on the third. A pool of viscous liquid, so still it looked solid, filled channels beneath the path. Shadows whispered between the warriors of the Unspeaking. They called to Abaddon, offering him power, wealth, and glory as they probed his soul for weakness. Lesser men would succumb, but Ezekiel Abaddon had no weaknesses, and he scorned the voice's feeble promises as he did all the temptations of the warp. Contempt armoured him. His will was a sword against the dark.
"It is a throne room fit for the Lord of the Primordial Truth," said Laek.
"It is a prison," said Abaddon.
He looked upon his father. Horus's face was swollen with power, its beauty lost beneath stretched skin. When awake, Horus still possessed the legendary charisma that made all men love him. When entranced like this, he was diminished, a hero past his best. It angered Abaddon to see him so, and tainted his love with pity.
"If Horus had not forbidden me from harming you, you would already be dead," Abaddon said. "I will hold to his word only so far, priest. Be careful what poisons you pour into my lord's ear. No order will prevent me taking your head if I deem the provocation sufficient."
"The truth poisons no one," said Laek mildly.
He appeared as ordinary as he possibly could at that moment. When he worked his sorcery, hoarfrost cloaked him. Strange scents rose from him. Blood oozed from his vox grill. But though he was currently bereft of the aura of dark magic, corruption left its mark. The bladed design of his helm and the six eye lenses arranged down its faceplate cheeks could have been a bizarre aesthetic conceit. Abaddon guessed they were not. He wondered what he would see when he finally slew Laek and tore the misshapen helmet from his head.
"Your truth is subjective," Abaddon growled. "Horus rose to free us from one tyrant, not submit us to four. He fights with them. He will not be beholden to your masters. Your certainty is your weakness."
"The Warmaster is not a slave," said Laek,
making no effort to hide his condescension.
He is the champion of the four. The power of the Eightfold Path is his to command.
I do not trust you, Apostle. I do not trust your words, or your faith, or your intentions.
Abaddon looked sideways at the word-bearer over the neck ring of his Terminator plate.
Know that the War Master does not trust you either, no matter what favor you currently have. You are a useful thing. When things no longer have their uses, they are discarded.
Still infuriatingly mild, Layak replied,
You have no idea, First Captain, what your father thinks or feels. You never will, until you allow yourself to worship as he does, and open yourself to the Pantheon.
Abaddon grunted and continued down the walkway. His feet rang loudly from the metal and stone. Layak's footsteps dogged his own. Four others followed them. Layak's mute blade slaves, and behind them two of Abaddon's Terminator-armored Justerin, their weight shuddering the deck with every step.
Layak's tread was the most grating, ever-present, following the First Captain everywhere he went.
Layak would not let him be. Horus more than tolerated his parasitic presence. He hearkened closely to what Layak said. Once, the religion Lorgar preached was resisted by Horus. Since Lorgar's attempted coup and subsequent banishment, principles Horus had found distasteful before seemed acceptable from Layak's lying mouth. It angered Abaddon that it was so. He did not like the faint streams of red, blue, pink, and green energies that, now he drew closer, he could see racing around his unconscious gene father. He liked none of it at all. Horus was changing. He had fallen without warning, bleeding from the cut the dog Russ had given him. When Malachurst the Twisted had brought the War Master back to them, it seemed to Abaddon that not all of Horus had returned. More magic, more trickery, more weakness. They halted before Horus. Infernal light bathed the War Master's face. Unconscious, he looked sickly, his face twisted by the powers of the warp, his handsomeness deformed, become lumpen and rough as the features of any narcotics addict or drunkard. His eyes twitched under swollen lids, his once full lips thinned to bloodless lines. A thread of drool snaked down from teeth that had become sharp. He was twisted, warp-touched, a bloated, swollen shadow of greatness enthroned. He seemed vast, like an extrusion of a hidden awful truth greater than a man. But he was less than a man, when once he had been so much more. Abaddon was reminded of the time Horus lay close to death on Davin, wounded by the Anathame, before he returned to his sons with new vigour and declared that the Emperor must fall. Then Abaddon had felt a lifetime's anguish. But now, each time Horus fell, he came back. Each time he came back, he was diminished. Horus still believed himself master of his own destiny. To Abaddon, it was clear he no longer was. By running to the lodges and heeding Erebus, Abaddon bore some responsibility for that, and the thought pricked him.
Layak hissed his quiet laugh. Oh, Abaddon, does your love for your father waver? Do you see him vulnerable and feel your regard curdle into disgust? He is not weakening, I assure you.
Abaddon turned so that he fully faced the apostle.
Speak so of the War Master again, and I shall kill you here.
Servos whined as Abaddon's Terminators presented their guns to fire. Bolts racked into chambers. In answer, heat rose from Layak's blade slaves as they began their transformation in preparation for combat. Layak laughed again.
You speak words of loyalty, but your reactions betray you. I voice only your thoughts. He is the vessel of chaos, the most high, the most exalted.
Layak knelt and bent his head.
The champion of the Pantheon. But you think he is weak?
He is the greatest being in this galaxy, said Abaddon. Not the prophet of your so-called gods.
He stared proudly at the War Master, ignoring the worms of doubt in his mind. He wanted to act, now, to strike down the priest and remove his taint. That moment would come.
Is that so?
Laeck's sextuple lenses flared defiantly. Abaddon's fingers twitched towards the massive combi bolter maglocked to his hip. His warriors tensed. Like their leader, the Justerin would have happily seen Laeck dead. They wanted the unspeaking and all the word-bearers away from their general. The heat from the blade slaves grew. Their armor cracked, forced apart by bodies swelling underneath. Flesh boiled out of the rents in the ceramite. Their unclean swords leapt from their scabbards into waiting hands, where they lengthened, additional mass unraveling from smoke and darkness into heavy, unnatural blades of bone. Ash sifted from the heat shimmer cloaking them. Embers drifting from their bodies hissed in the black channels below the walk. They presented their weapons, hunching into combat postures far removed from the forms trained into them as legionaries. With one gesture, Abaddon could condemn them all. He clenched his fists and looked sidelong at his men. One gesture.
"You would slaughter me while I pay your respect to your genesire," said Laeck. "I saved your life first, Captain. There is a cost to that."
"I saved yours too, if I recall. I owe you nothing."
Laeck raised his hand and twitched his fingers. The blade slaves stood to attention. The hell light burning in their helm lenses dimmed, and their swords shrank away until they looked like any legionary gladius, and were sheathed. Abaddon grunted dismissively.
"Your death will be an unwelcome distraction," he said.
He looked back to his father. The light of the energies racing around Horus's head played over the armor of the group.
"When will he awake?"
"He does not sleep," said Laeck. "Horus's affinity with the warp grows by the hour. His powers swell. The War Master has gone into the past."
He clasped his strange staff in front of him and bowed his head.
"Pray with me," he said. "For your father goes to seek out the Emperor."
Terror. The past. Having allowed himself the briefest glimpse of Terra's approaching orb, Horus kept his eyes closed during the whole of the descent. He wanted his first sight of the world to be the interior of his father's palace, for that was where all the power of mankind was concentrated.
"I look to the future. The grey dust of today's terror is the past."
That was what he told his companions when they asked why he closed his eyes. They smiled at his words. Horus had a way with men, to speak profundity laced with humour that did not lessen what he spoke of, but raised it up. When he joked, he mocked himself. When he teased his friends, he did so more gently than he teased himself. He was humble in his confidence. To be in his company was to feel oneself his comrade, regardless of what station one might hold.
"The matter of terror is greater than I," he said,
as the dropship started the shake and moan of re-entry. He settled into his restraints, nestling his great head in the padded brace.
"I want to see what will be, not what has been. Terror is old and used up, but it will be great again. The palace of the Emperor is the center of this change. From it, authority shall spread, uniting mankind as one people for the first time in thousands of years. Why would I look upon the ruin of what is now, when one day the world shall live again and thrill to new life returned to it by the efforts of the highest power? When my father's work is done, and all old Earth's glories are restored, then I shall look upon it fully."
"So long as it leads to a good fight,"
growled the first of his companions, the largest and the strongest. The other three of his four companions spoke their agreement. They relaxed and shut their eyes too. Always men copied his example, out of respect and love. They fell through the sky in silence, rocked hard by pockets of denser air, until the thrusters ignited and burnt to full, and the party felt themselves grow heavier. Landing claws spread upon the ground with loud rings. The ship's roaring engines cut out and were replaced by a noise greater still.
"My lord, they are shouting your name,"
said the fourth of his companions, his voice pure as silver bells.
"Lead me to them," said Horus,
his eyes still closed. The restraint cradle clacked open and rose with a hiss. His companions took his giant hands in theirs and guided him eagerly to the gangplank. Waves of adulation roared into the hold as the doors parted and the ramp fell, so loud Horus's ears sang and his warriors had to shout to be heard.
"They love you, my lord! They love you!" said his second companion.
"They do not know me," said Horus.
"They love you anyway,"
shouted the second. He was wise, his words considered, but there was an undertone of suspicion in his voice that resonated with Horus's own most guarded fears, and the Primarch's smile wavered.
"Come, my lord, come! Such life is in the crowd! Such pleasure to be had,"
said the third companion.
"A profusion of people! They call to you!"
The others were enthused by the jollity of the third, even the grim and growling first, and pulled Horus down the gangplank. The noise grew louder as he emerged from the shadow of the ship's belly, and the people saw him.
"Open your eyes," whispered the fourth sweetly.
Horus did so to the cheers of a million people. The Emperor, his father, had prepared him as best he could for the sight of the Imperial Palace, but what Horus had taken for boastfulness, he saw now was modesty. The Emperor's description of his plans had in no way encapsulated what Horus saw. Only half finished, the Imperial Palace exceeded anything he had ever seen. Nothing on Chthonia could compare. Not even the great starships that had come for him and borne him away from his home came close in scale or majesty or ambition. For only the second time in his life, Horus felt awe.
"Such vision," he said.
"It is overweening," said his second companion. "His understanding of history's flow is simplistic, and his project will fall."
"If it does, it will fall and rise again, as all things fall and rise," said the third.
"It is beautiful," said the fourth.
The first said nothing. Horus glanced askance at him. The four were his brothers from Chthonia, warriors who had been with him since the beginning, but he found at that precise moment that he could not recall their names. The first had a warrior's ugliness, pitted and battered, his nose flat, shaved head scarred, forever on the edge of violence. The second was a scholar, waspish in temperament. Heterochromatic eyes looked calculatingly upon everything. His face shifted into uncertain shapes beyond the human form. Horus frowned. He did not know their names. The third was heavier than the rest, fully fleshed and jolly, yet flakes of skin at the corner of his mouth and red rims around his eyes displayed an imbalance in his humours. The fourth distracted him, slipping his slender hand back into Horus's own and leading him deeper into the palace.
"My brother! My lord!"
he laughed gaily. This one wore his hair in elaborate knots and coloured his cheeks. His eyes were bright with pleasure.
"They adore you!"
Music played from every quarter. Wafers of gold leaf fluttered from the spires either side of the road. The buildings were tall and beautiful, but every window lacked for glass. Columns waiting for statues were placed at 50-metre intervals until they ran out, and only sockets for their placing were visible. Not far from the processional way, the marble cladding gave way to rockcrete, and the rich pavement stopped. Nothing was finished. Freezing wind whipped up the crimson standards, each flap and flutter drawing the eye to another incomplete artwork or another tower swathed in scaffolding. The thin air carried multiple chemical taints blown up from the poisoned world. The whole place was a work in progress, yet the people within the unfinished walls cheered and roared as if they were already triumphant, ignorant of how very far they had to go to achieve their master's dream. The road Horus and his four companions trod was of a gleaming stone, amber as a lion's eyes. Upon it was a purple carpet a kilometre in length. At the end, on a dais made with enough art and beauty to persist 10,000 years, though it would be demolished as soon as Horus professed his fealty, was a throne of gold. A double-headed eagle formed its back, its wings outspread, its claws grasping stylized lightning bolts, which thrust jaggedly out over the crowds lining the way.
It was preposterously sized. Horus himself, bigger than any two mortal men combined, would have vanished into its seat. But even though the being upon it seemed to be but a man, and no gene-forged giant, he overfilled it, his presence spilling out in a blaze of light so glaring Horus had to narrow his eyes to keep walking forwards. His four companions hung back, afraid. Though they had seen the Emperor before, and borne his presence bravely, this time they'd trailed after Horus like frightened children. He lost respect for them, there and then, that they never fully recovered. Was that how it was? Something was wrong with all this. He had lived these events before, he was sure. The palace had all the solidity of a memory, a spun-glass recollection perfect in every detail, as all his memories were, but nothing more than a fragile echo of time gone, never to be experienced again. The four who accompanied him were the cause of the dissonance. The advisers who walked with him the day he came to Terra were not these four men. Those companions had been his first Mournival, beloved comrades from Chthonia who were too old to take legionary apotheosis and who aged and died with disappointing rapidity. It was right that these false friends should hang back. They should not have been there. Something in the light hated them. Horus walked through the roaring acclaim, and his humility fled before it. So many shouts for a being the crowd did not know or understand, and never could. He was a weapon made by an oppressor. If his so-called father had commanded him, he would have killed every single one of them without a thought, and he would have made the massacre seem just. That was the truth of it. The Emperor was anything but just. His achievements were founded on falsehood. The Emperor was a liar. Horus looked at the palace again. The towering arches were the expression of arrogance. The walls, symbols of oppression. The very idea of Imperium was inimical to the freedom every man had held dear since the first examples of humanity dropped from the trees and walked out into the grasslands. The Emperor was a tyrant, like every other tyrant.
"Can you not see what he is?" Horus shouted boldly. "He brings you slavery in the guise of liberation."
But the words were not heard by the crowd. He could not affect the memory. Time is a river. It flows only where it can. It is bound by laws as sure as that of gravity. Horus cheatingly followed the path of before, like a man can return to a river's source and walk its length again. He remembered now. Events must play out as they did. Some beings, however, are timeless. Through the act of remembering, Horus escaped time's shackles. The Emperor's soul had never felt time's lash so heavily as other men, and so there, in memory, father and son met. Horus's spirit walked out of step with his former self. He looked through the back of his own head as his past and present moved out of synchronization. How naive he had been. How excited by this outpouring of affection. He had been taken in completely. He allowed himself to be angry about that. Horus and his small party came to the foot of the steps. From the great chair, the Emperor stared down at him. There was imperious pride and triumph in his face as he looked upon his creation. But no love. Never that. From the vantage of the present, Horus looked back upon the Emperor's affection and saw it for a sham. Back then, he had not known. Back then, he had believed. Horus of Chthonia and Warmaster Horus knelt before the man who would become a god. The first shaking with joy at reunion with his father, the second disgusted by himself. Silence fell. From his high seat, the Emperor intoned, "Horus of Chthonia, do you swear fealty to me, your creator, the Emperor of mankind? Do you swear to serve me faithfully, to bring the light of the Imperium to every world touched by the hand of our people,
to protect them from the dark, to deliver them from ignorance, to give them succor when they are in need, to guide them where they falter, to save them when they are in danger. The emperor went on with his list of pompous demands. Warmaster Horus looked up while his weakling former self grovelled in the light. His mouth split far wider than a human's could, evincing a reptilian smile. "Hello, father," he said. "It is not enough that you pursue me through metaphor and dreamscapes. Now you chase me down the roads of what has been," said the emperor. "I will chase you where I must, father," he replied. His smile spread. "You sound tired." Snow whipped past Horus from the shadows of a forest hidden on the edge of sight. Lupine shapes prowled behind him, panting hot breaths, eyes of red, green, pink and blue shining from shadowy faces. "Be careful, Horus," the too perfect voice rang in his head. "The past gives me strength. It has worn itself into the fabric of things and cannot be altered. It is not mutable like the place you made your last attempt on my soul. And that did not end so well for you." Light flared. Horus was pushed back away from his former self as he ecstatically pledged to follow the cause of crusade. Behind the glare, Horus saw another emperor, a man in pain, bound to a seat he could not leave, holding back a tide of darkness while a lone sentinel waited, hammer in hand, before a sealed gate. And past that, a third version of the emperor, fleetingly glimpsed. This one a corpse, trapped within a machine grown monstrous around his throne. The Warmaster laughed and pushed back, drawing on the might of his allies. "I was weak. Now I am not." The light dimmed. "The truth makes me strong." "False strength derived from false truths. As you draw it, it eats you alive from the inside. Drag upon their lies as much as you wish. You are not strong enough to come against me in this way, my wayward son. And you never shall be." The emperor of the past continued to speak. "Will you, Horus, first of my primarchs, stand by my side and shepherd humanity into a new era of prosperity and peace, where no Xenos race might oppress us, and no fault of our nature undo us?" The emperor stared at him with his rich brown eyes, and it was the man of the past and the man of the moment combined when he spoke next. "Do you swear this, Horus? Do you swear it?" Light swamped Horus Lupercal's form and cast him from nowhere into somewhere. The Vengeful Spirit, Lunar Orbit, 14th of Secundus. An hour passed before Laoc raised his head. "He returns to us." The lights circling Horus sped faster and faster, grew brighter, burst apart and fled, shrieking for the furthest corners of the hall, where they died in flickers of witchfire. A moment later, Horus stirred. His eyelids flickered like those of a stupefied man coming round, showing only the whites and refusing to open fully.
"Horus!"
Abaddon moved for his father. Laoc's hand shot out and grasped his forearm.
"Do not touch him," he hissed.
Frost spread over the Warmaster's black armour, turning the glaring eye on his chest milky blind. It melted as fast as it formed. The reactor buried within the Warmaster's battleplate whined with building power, and Horus lolled sideways with a groan, pawing at the arms of his seat for support.
"Father,"
said Abaddon, appalled by the display of weakness. Horus held up his hand to silence his son. The jolting of his Terminator armor prevented him from slumping far forwards, but his head hung within the cowl.
"Father!"
Abaddon repeated.
"I am well, my son. Do not be afraid," said the Primarch.
He lifted his eyes to meet Abaddon's.
In the dark they shone silverly, like those of a felid caught in a beam of light.
You disgrace yourself with your fretting, First Captain. Nothing ails me. Far from it.
With a sigh of armour motors, Horace Lupercal stood. Light danced along the claws of his armour as he activated them and inspected them, and skittered away to nothing when he shut them down. Abaddon relaxed. There was the man he had pledged to follow. There was his father. There was the future Emperor of Mankind.
The Emperor is afraid. Our time comes, Horace said.
His huge head turned, taking in the party before him, as if seeing them for the first time.
Why do you disturb my meditations?
Why are you not on your ship, Abaddon?
I wish to see you for myself, my lord,
said Abaddon. Energy beat upon him from Horus's engorged soul.
Kneel,
it demanded.
Kneel before me.
Abaddon would not kneel.
I wanted to look at your face with my own eyes,
Abaddon continued,
and ask you why, when terror is within our grasp, do we delay?
Horus stared at him, the weight of his regard pushed at Abaddon's being.
Kneel,
the demand came again, this time fully voiced within his mind. Abaddon's armor sighed as his muscles strained within his terminator plate. He would not kneel.
You wait too long, father, Abaddon continued. Your armies stand ready for your command. Everything is in place. The last Geno temples of the Selenites are in our hands. All resistance has been purged from Terra's orbits. The bombardment proceeds as you ordered. Terra burns, my lord. But we wait here. We give our enemies time. We give them strength.
We are not yet gathered, said Horus.
Such power was contained in his words, it scalded Abaddon's soul.
You push at the bounds of your authority, my son.
I will not apologize, nor shall I beg your forgiveness, said Abaddon. The Mournival exists to speak truth to you, and I do so now. We risk everything. Mortarion, Primarch of the Death Guard, and all his legion have broken warp and sail for our position, he continued. You should know this and be ready to act. Instead, I find you slumped on your throne. You allow yourself to be influenced by this priest. You waste your time in worship.
Careful, Ezekiel, Horus said. I worship nothing.
Your forces are complete. We should begin our invasion now. Do not tarry, Horus. Strike the final blow.
For dangerous seconds, Horus stared at his son. Strange fires leapt behind his eyes, and Abaddon feared he witnessed the bonfire of Horus's soul consumed. In so many ways it was too terrible a sight to endure, but he held his father's polluted gaze. Horus suddenly moved down from his throne dais, his vast bulk pushing past the lesser beings at his feet as he headed for the chamber door.
"Mortarion is late,"
growled Horus,